Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Laurel Guy. Guy is the program director for the Constance Saltonstall Foundation for the Arts. She's also a visual artist and a writer. Welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Listen, I want to talk a little bit later about your work with the Saltonstall, but I'd like to begin with the personal. I know you're a visual artist and a writer. Did creative expression come from your childhood? Or
oh, yes,
where did
indeed.
It arrive from?
I definitely was born this way. I'm an idea person, and I just get excited about everything. Everything gives me ideas, and as I've gotten older, it seems like many of the forms my ideas take are to inspire others. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense...
So did you start painting and writing when you were a child?
Oh,
were
yeah.
Were you encouraged?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So... And I've forgiven my mother of everything she ever did to me because she saved the very first painting I ever made.
No kidding.
On a paper towel. You know those brown paper towels that they have?
Oh, yeah, they still have those in
schools.
Yeah,
so I forgave her all the other stuff because she kept that, and it's actually kind of a cool painting. Oh. So.
And so where were you brought up?
Well, I've had intensive speech therapy, so maybe you can't tell that I was born in California, but somehow... We went against the flow. We ended up in Oklahoma. You know, the Okies were supposed to migrate
west.
Your
accent is coming out loud and clear, Laurel.
So several years in the Southwest, and then we moved to Kentucky where it was even more of a twang. And then I went back to college in San Antonio at Trinity University. So by the time I meandered up to upstate New York, I really needed to... that accent.
Do you consider yourself a Southerner?
No.
Not
I
at
feel
all,
like
huh?
I escaped. That they let me out at the border, and I was fortunate enough to get out.
Well, how much do you think place and where you were brought up has to do with vision, though? Do you think you can ever get away from where you were originated? Because I don't think I can.
Well, I would say in terms of vision, I have unusual parents, very unusual parents, and so I'm sure that a lot of it comes from... my actual family, and I am definitely imprinted with the Southwest landscape, not the politics that have evolved since, you know, but the landscape, the sky and so forth is definitely my natural home. I'm very connected to that part of the country, but my heart is in upstate New York, and I resist the winter, but my heart is here, the people and the beauty, the natural beauty call to me every day.
Yeah, I love it here, too. I'm from California as well. You probably don't know that, but I'm from Southern California.
Great.
And I love the seasons here.
Mm-hmm.
But I am starting to resist, after 6 years, the winters.
Yeah.
Sounding like a native.
Well, what keeps us here is the amnesia that happens. We fall back in love in spring, and we forget. And right now we're starting to recall.
Yes.
The pain is on its way.
That's right. So you work in pastels in the open air.
Right, plein air.
Did it take you a while to figure out what kind of medium you wanted to use to
express
yourself?
Absolutely. You know, in terms of that, it's interesting. Acrylics, watercolor. I was very happy with that for 20 years.
Really?
And I can't even remember how it was that I fell into pastels. I mean, I have lots of art supplies, so I maybe just picked them up one day. But I made a series for particular paintings that I still have, pastel paintings. I call them paintings because if technically you're using pigment, pastels are... the same pigment that's in oil paints, just without the liquid. And if you cover the paper fully, it's painting. And if there's paper showing through, then that's a pastel drawing. And so you're using special, I use special archival sanded paper. Mm. But back to those four drawings. Those four drawings were amazing because they came through me. You know, they were not unconscious drawings. I certainly was aware of what I was doing, but it was as though someone else had made them. It was a completely different way of creating art happened, and I've used that same ever since.
And then you gave up
it's very
watercolors.
Pure. Absolutely, I'm not interested in any other form because there's a lot of creativity comes through your hands. If you really look through it, you know, music, talk to any musician, a jazz musician, a concert pianist, and how your hands remember. and many art forms, including the one I'm using with pastel. I have no paintbrush. I have nothing, just my fingers against the paper. And if I get out of the way, if I get my ego and my, you know, critic out of the way, the fingers will do the rest. You know, I'm obviously paying attention. I'm out there. My eyes are looking at a specific scene. I see colors that I can't capture. You know, taking a picture is not, that's not my medium, mm-hmm. because the final product of the photograph won't have those colors that I see. My perception mm-hmm. is not filtered to the lens.
I've always thought
of
pastels as a really difficult medium, mm. and if they're done wrong, they can be so bad.
Yeah, I find it just works for me. Maybe it's different.
No, your stuff
for
is
others.
Great.
Yeah, for
yeah,
others.
It really works for you.
Yeah,
that's so amazing.
Yeah.
So you were influenced by the Impressionists, correct?
I guess I try not to be influenced by anyone, honestly. I'm certainly called. The first painter that I was really passionate about was Georgia O'Keeffe, and I think because of her skies, I don't think my work looks like her, but what I'm inspired by is her independence.
Uh-huh. So it's
and
her character as well.
It's her
as
character
her work.
And how she, at an early point in her artistic life, threw away the rules. Yes, you have to learn the rules, but there was a moment in her life where she put every painting she had around the walls, you know, just leaning them against the walls, and she could look at each one and go, okay, that style came from that teacher, that came from that teacher, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And at that point, she gave up oil paints. She started with charcoal, and it was 6 months until she needed the color blue. She decided, you know, everything else in your life, you know, you have to do, like, you have to have a job, you have to conform.
You have to conform,
but art is something that you should allow to come through you. Let it be what it is. Try not to judge it. And that's what inspires me about her, and that's what I try to do with my own work.
Mm-hmm. So have you ever had formal training?
Oh, yeah. I've taken plenty of art classes in
college. And you're still trying to get it out of your system,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, an inspiring professor I had in Texas in life drawing. I'm actually very capable of doing representational work. You know, mm-hmm. I can draw anything and have it look that as a child, as a young child, I could do that without any problem, portraits, anything. And so in this life drawing class, he's walking around and I'm thinking, boy, I'm doing a great job with this particular drawing. And he stood behind me and just looking at what I was working on for a while. And then his only comment was, why do you try so hard to make it look like what it looks like? And, of course, he made me really mad because, hey, it's a great drawing. But I absorbed his comments.
So you were trying very hard to conform.
Yeah. And so for the rest of that semester, I didn't try. And my work became extremely interesting, where people would stand and watch me.
And you felt that as well, because you thought the original drawing that he didn't like was good.
Oh, well, yeah, it was. I mean, it was a compositionally and uh-huh. technically it was an excellent drawing, but he's saying, hey, there's something else going on. Why don't you let it out?
Uh-huh. You need to put your soul and heart
into
it.
Once you get your ego out of the way, and I try to inspire other artists and writers to trust their own voice. But first you have to find your voice.
That's right. And that might be one of the hardest things for people
yeah,
to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. You know, back to Georgia O'Keeffe, it seems like women still are trying to make it in the art world. They're not paid as much. They aren't recognized in the numbers that men are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's changing at all? Has Georgia O'Keeffe and some of the other women artists, Joan Mitchell and some of the famous ones, helped forge the way?
Absolutely. I think so.
Or is it still
tough? Probably if Georgia were sitting here, she would just say, I'm an artist, not a woman artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she just wanted to be judged on her work. And I think, I'm sure there is obviously a bias, but you have to just focus on your work and get it out there.
It seems like Georgia O'Keeffe was able to really accomplish what she did because she became an independent woman, too. A room of one's own kind of thing.
Well, she accomplished, if we're going to talk about Georgia, she mm-hmm. accomplished what she accomplished because of Alfred Stieglitz. If she hadn't have met Alfred, she would still be making fabulous art in Texas, you know, in Amarillo, Texas,
uh-huh.
where
she
was teaching.
Helped.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was her mentor. And at that time, especially, you know, he lifted her out of in a way that that's what made her so unique, is because mm-hmm. he celebrated her work. He saw her as the icon of the American woman, and that her art was fresh American art, that it was the iconic American art, not just from a woman, but in general, that we were breaking away from the whole stranglehold that European art had on our artists here, you know, that pioneer Midwestern spirit. Yeah, I can go
on and on
about her.
Not to mention some gorgeous photographs that he took of her. What a gorgeous woman she was.
Yeah, that was, absolutely inspiring couple.
So art has obviously been a deep part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that it could be everyone's
I believe
destiny?
Everyone is an artist.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's not a theoretical statement. I mean, people laugh at that concept. You know, if I were in a first grade classroom and asked everyone, how many of you are artists? They would all raise their hand.
Yeah, they would.
And if I had a room full of adults in here with us, Tish, then I asked the same question, probably three would tentatively raise their hands. And it's sad because they've forgotten that they are, that the most creative act of all is their own life, that each day it's...
People are constantly having to censor themselves.
Though. Yeah.
They feel like they have to.
Well, it's
because
sad.
Of self-consciousness or whatever it is. Not feeling like they belong.
Right.
Trying too hard sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
I often tell people, because I'm surprised at how few people know this particular bit of trivia, so I want to spread it out there, which is in Bali. There is no word for artist in Balinese. And the reason for that is because everyone is an artist.
Hmm.
And they may have other jobs. I mean, they might be the plumber or they might be, you know, the doctor or whatever, you know. Hmm. But they're also an artist. And everything they do in their daily life is to create beauty. They all have the ability to make art. And it wasn't even until the 50s that people in Bali signed their work. Because why would they? You know, that we in our Western culture, we separate out. We go, oh, you're an artist. You know, is that something that we should put on a pedestal?
Mm-hmm.
And no, there shouldn't be that gap. We've created a gap like the Grand Canyon when, in fact, we all share this. That's why we're inspired by art, because it's reminding us of something that we long for in our own life, you know, that we're hungry for.
It's a primal
It is.
Need to see beauty, I think.
Yeah, it is.
I've always thought as well.
Absolutely.
Well, what is it that inspires you day to day
in
regard to your creative life?
Everything. I mean, everything can, you know, from it could be something that I'm reading. I'm a voracious reader. Conversation is the ocean that we swim in every day. So I get lots of ideas and give lots of ideas through conversation. My kids, my dogs, just, you know, walking the dog and seeing what the dog's looking at and reminding myself to slow down and look at everything.
Uh-huh. And listen, too.
And listen, you know, I work in a gorgeous place, you know, that's beautiful every moment. I just raced down here in a thunderous, storming
yes,
day,
<you did. laughs>
which is also inspiring, so... And, you know, other people's work, other artists, other writers,
and you're somebody
creative
who goes
people.
And you visit galleries and are interested in other people's work?
I'm very passionate about other people's work. In my own position at the Salt and Style Foundation, I meet incredible New York State artists and writers, and encouraging them and talking with them about their work is every day something new. It's an explosion happens. And it feeds you. It's like food. And when you starve yourself or you're on a junk food diet, meaning you just, your only source of inspiration is the TV.
I was just going to say.
Or movies, which, hey, I like TV and I like movies, but that's like eating, you know, Snickers. You know, you got to have something that's really feeding your soul. You know, a really great book. A fantastic book.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is the one and only Laurel Guy. This is I was going through your website, and I noticed the essay that you wrote about what is a painting worth.
Yeah,
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about some of your thoughts that came out in that essay.
Well, I wish I could remember it. I forgot to tell you about my short-term memory loss.
Oh, but, is that so?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, you were talking about how Joe Schmo could make a painting, but it wouldn't be worth as much as Van Gogh. Or,
well,
you know.
Right. You know, the whole pricing of work is so arbitrary and unfair But I'm not whining. I'm just saying that that is that's the culture that we're in. And Van Gogh didn't see any of his. It's so ironic that his paintings are worth so much. He just must be just cracking up over that because he certainly didn't see it.
But that's probably why people are afraid to discover their own artist in themselves, because it is judged like this. You know,
well,
Joe Schmo might have his most gorgeous of paintings.
Yeah, but you know, you can also. I'm not that attached to that structure, and I don't let that affect me in any way. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't.
The structure of being paid.
I'm going to make my own way. I encourage anyone who's listening who is wondering about this question, make your own way. Don't worry about the gallery structure. If you can work within that structure, great. Otherwise, think out of the box. Mm-hmm. We have the internet. We don't need that structure, actually. We can market ourselves just fine without
it. Yeah, things have changed. A great deal.
You know, I find that the only thing that's important is that someone likes your work, and if they want your work, they will purchase it. Mm-hmm. And you need to get your work out there.
I was going to say, it has to be seen, yeah.
Yeah, you can't be, you know, the tree in the forest. So you do have to embrace that aspect of it, which I do. You know, marketing is just part of it, you know, and it can be a very satisfying part because you're connecting with people, which is part of the reason of doing it, and a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I'll tell you a story, not so much about pricing work, but there's an artist in Ithaca, a beloved artist who's no longer with us, Peter Kahn. And I learned an incredible lesson. He, in 1997, I helped curate a show of his work. He was the Ithaca Festival artist for that year, and his wife, Ruth, did not really want, she has a huge body of his work, but she felt a great show would be if we contacted old friends of Peter's and they would loan work that they had of his that had never been hung in a show together. And so each person, I was waiting at the gallery for each person to drop off their work of that they had, their treasured work of Peter's. And each person, it was like a child. You know, and they said, be careful, and this is hung in my kitchen for 20 years, and nothing can happen to it. And I realized how important it is that your work gets out there. And I love to see my work in other people's homes and offices because it adds life to their life.
Right, exactly. You know, let's talk about your public life. You were the director of the Ithaca Festival for 11 years, very successfully. Now you're the program director at Saltonstall. The theme running through your life seems to be bringing community together. Well, why is that so important to you?
I don't know, and if anyone knows me really well, they would really laugh. First off, my mother knows my secret, which is that I'm probably the most disorganized, chaotic person on the planet, very much a master procrastinator.
Honestly?
Yes. Well, you should know because I forgot to come to this interview.
Yeah, she showed up a little late, ladies and gentlemen.
And the other thing is that I'm really a solitary person. I'm not a person that really, you know, I have my circle of friends, and I have, obviously, I know many, many people and enjoy the connections that I have. And I try to make meaningful connections with people, but I'm really a solitary person. So it is interesting that
so you've taken
that
these things on to bring out that other side
I
of yourself.
I don't know.
Perhaps.
I feel like I have no choice. Like somehow there's something in me, and I just trust that it's another art form, really, that I'm supposed to be doing this because it's not something that I would naturally choose for myself. I find it, people come to me, and I trust it that I should be doing it. And also the ideas that I have, I try to breathe new life into these forms, you know, whether it's a festival or a salon, which is really just a reading with food.
Yeah, I want to talk to you more about the salons that you've started with Saltonstall. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, it is. It's I just try, whatever I'm doing, I try to, there's something in me that sees things a little bit differently and sometimes a lot differently. And instead of censoring it, I let it out. And I have an innate sense of what an audience would like. I have a theater background. I've written plays. When I go to the movies, I listen and watch the audience as much as I watch what's on screen.
I actually do that as well.
And so I really understand what's going to strike a chord with people, and it gives me great pleasure because I have learned through all of these things that when you bring people together in one time, in one place, there's a power, there is something profound, it's a connection that we all crave, a meaningful conversation instead of small talk.
Mm-hmm.
That is the original intent behind the Salt and Stahl Salon series, which it's basically a series of 12 different events over these coming six months. And our next one is, you know, it's on the second Sundays in October, November, December, mm-hmm. January, February, March.
Right.
Count 6 months. And should I say where they happen, or do you want me more to talk about?
Well, I'm
going to
let you give some contact information at the end.
Okay, so let's not be too boring about that part.
This reminds me of like Bloomsbury and the Algonquin meeting,
yes.
Dorothy Parker,
yes.
and Gertrude Stein and Virginia Woolf.
Oh, I've always been
fascinated. I absolutely
love
the idea of it as well.
Maybe I had a past life in Paris in the 20s. I don't know. I just don't know. But I've always been interested in the art of conversation. It's something that we've lost a little bit of, you know, and in earlier centuries, people were very thoughtful about their words. They brought quotes into their conversation.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to, you know, it wasn't just splashing around in the ocean of words. They mm-hmm. were really trying to make something beautiful and meaningful and profound happen. And it's possible to do that. And so the salons took a simple idea, writers reading from their work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how many readings have you gone to, Tish, in your lifetime?
Quite a few, because I lived in San Francisco for a long time.
Well,
I used to go all the time.
Right, but I think a lot of people are guilty of not going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they read about it, they think, oh, you know, I would go, and then they don't. It's like going to a gallery opening.
Uh-huh.
Good idea, but then you just can't quite get there.
And there's nothing like listening to an author read his or her own work. It's
nothing.
Just astounding.
Yeah, it's so exciting. So, but what I did is I gave it a little bit of a twist. For me, art is food. You know, it does feed your soul. So why not combine it with food?
Mm-hmm.
So all of the Salt and Stahl's events feature fabulous food, always, wherever they are.
Uh-huh.
And so the salon, the literary salons, you come, it's a Sunday, which is a day that people kind of sigh, just have a little bit of a breather.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a fabulous Sunday brunch. Now, right there, I'm happy, right? And then we have not just one writer reading, we have three writers, different genres, and reading briefly from their work. And this is the real magic. Each writer reads maybe 7 to 10 minutes. So you get a little taste of their work.
Mm-hmm.
You've eaten, you have a full stomach, you can concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have these writers reading. And what happens, the thing that I didn't expect, is the chemistry that happens from these different voices, that something happens when you hear one. It's like different courses in a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they're wonderful. We live in an area, a region, that's just filled with incredible writers. We have a street in Fall Creek, the Tioga Street, that's called Writer's Block because so many published writers live on it.
That's
so
great.
I'm cherry picking. I can bring fantastic writers to you. And it's like the best of theater. It's like the feeling that you get when you leave a wonderful play and you're just, wow, that was fantastic. And what do you want to do? You want to talk about the play.
And so does the audience actually start questioning the writers? And
well,
it's speaking
not
with
a
them.
Formal. It's not a formal conversation. It's
uh-huh.
not someone talking at you. It's not a lecture. The writers read from their work, and we've created in Olivia, where these take place, the literary salons, there are community tables.
Ah.
So you come with your friends to the salon, and you're going to sit at a table maybe with other people you know or acquaintances or people that you meet for the first time that day. And it's like being in theater, in a theater, you've shared this experience, but you've shared it in the dark. So you don't generally get to talk to hear these people. You're sitting right next to them. Uh-huh. But here, after the readings are done, they've seeded the conversation that's now going to happen at your table. People linger over coffee and tea, and they talk about it. And I hear from them. I hear, in fact, I got we had our first one in October, and people drove down from Syracuse, which I was like, wow. Mm-hmm. And this woman wrote to me and just said how incredible it was. The people that she met. It's not just the food. It's the writers are exquisite, mm-hmm. but it's that other thing that we're hungry for, which is a real conversation and making a real connection, maybe with someone that you didn't know. And that's what people have incredible conversations with other members of the audience.
Mm-hmm. Did you invite the writers, or do people call you and say, I want to participate in this?
This is a new idea, I invited the writers. We started it last winter at the Willow restaurant in Ithaca in Fall Creek. And you know, I didn't know what to expect. I thought, well, you know, it's the dead of winter, 20, 30 people come. It was standing room only.
Wow, that's amazing.
Is it standing room only at a reading? Hello, food.
Yeah, people are hungry for this.
People are hungry.
And you might even start up some of those literary feuds, like from the past, between Dorothy Parker and Mary McCarthy.
Yeah. So I encourage people to make reservations, though, because it is very, very popular. It's, you know, and people leave after the brunch, and they're on cloud 10 for the rest of the afternoon because it's so inspiring. You mm-hmm. think about the work. It continues to resonate. Mm-hmm. You think about the conversations, and, of course, you're still digesting that fabulous brunch.
I would assume people would maybe go buy the book to read.
Absolutely.
More of whatever the work was that was read.
The writers have, you know, signed copies of the books for sale if you want. Mm-hmm. And the brunch is reasonably priced. It's a fixed price. It's $15, and it's all you can eat, and it's wonderful food. So,
do you think that people should mix art with politics? Will you be doing that in any of these salons?
I think politics is yet another art form. Mm-hmm. It's been completely corrupted
it's
recently.
It's definitely a spectator sport in some places.
Yeah, it's a blood sport. So, yeah, absolutely. We have a literary salon series. We also have a visual artist salon series that will start in January at the Museum of the Earth. And I have a third series, a creativity salon series that will happen at the Saltonstall Arts Colony. Mm. And, yeah, I'm envisioning, you know, several, you know, on different themes. And I would love to work with young people.
I was going to say, I love kids in art. I love encouraging kids.
Yeah, you know, in terms of young writers, young artists, to give them the same opportunity. It will work a similar way with the artist salons that will happen at the Museum of the Earth, except it will be a Sunday afternoon tea. And I mean, not just tea and cookies. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about
a high tea, perhaps.
Yes. You know.
How can people get in touch with you in regard to these salons? We're running out of time
here. Call me up. 607-539-3146. Again, 607-539-3146. Oh, you don't have your pencil. Go to www.saltonstall.org. And that is SaltonStall, one word, Saltonstall. We're the Constance Saltonstall Foundation for the Arts.
Laurel Guy, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.